Ready for you? Well, good morning. The title of this message is going to be One Blood. It's an examination of Paul's statement in Acts 17:26 about God making of one blood all men, which I think most of you are familiar with. It's also going to be an examination of this book which recently came out titled One Blood, which was written by three Christian authors. They had to collaborate to get this book done. And I actually got two of these books sent to me, people wanting for me to address the topic of this book, and because it's a topic that has been constantly brought up in regards to equality and universalism and why all the races are the same in the eyes of God and things like that. Now, there seems to be a purpose to this book. And the purpose of this book is what has been going on in recent times. In recent times, there's a lot of information coming up regarding the races. Biblical evidence, you know, why God treated certain people differently. The teaching of Israel identity, which is mentioned briefly in here, is another reason that this book was written. It was written to counter all the scientific and statistical data on the races, such as crime statistics, aptitude and IQ statistics, medical evidence which explains why certain races have diseases and others don't, and certain organs and bone structures are physically different among the races, and the evidence of history, why civilizations, cultures, and governments of some races have advanced and others have stayed stagnant. And every day we're confronted with some of these. I've got some evidence of that today. I happen to bring this newspaper article. It's the St. Paul Pioneer Press. It's from May 7th, 2001. And the headlines on the front page is School Race Gap Targeted. Subheading, St. Paul Meeting to Zero In on Black Kids' Achievement. It states this, quote, 15 years of district test data show that few signs that the gap between the white and black students has closed. Strategies and blue ribbon commissions have come and gone, along with superintendents, school boards, and students. Yet achievement patterns remain frustratingly consistent. They've tried everything they could, new teachers, new curriculum, boards, commissions to examine this issue. Nothing works. We've got problems with riots throughout the country. In Cincinnati, it says, Cincinnati whites swear revenge. Gun and ammunition sales skyrocket over the last 3 days in Ohio, Kentucky, and nearby Indiana. It began on Tuesday when swarms of blacks began looting stores, setting fires to buildings, smashing car windows, and pulling white people out of cars, kicking their heads to a bloody mess. It goes on the same thing in Biloxi that this happened. It also happened in California. We have these riots. The races just don't seem to get together very well. And so we keep having all these things that confront us every day, and that created a great need for a book like this. Actually, most of these issues, like the statistics and the history and things like that, are not directly covered in this book. Now, one thing interesting about this book is that the foreword was written by Zig Ziglar. I thought that was really odd. Zig Ziglar, you know, he's this motivational speaker that people have from him. Here's what he said. As you read One Blood, I hope you will carefully check the scriptures that are revealed and the scientific evidence that is presented. I believe it will remove virtually all of your prejudice. Of course, the real difficulty is a heart problem and not an intellectual problem. As you read this book, follow through on the biblical admonitions and ask God to come into your heart in the person of Jesus Christ, because when our heart is right, then all of us is right. Now, that's an interesting statement. He's saying the problem is not an intellectual one, it's a problem of the heart. And the way he's right, In other words, people are using their minds when it comes to issues of race. They're using their intellect, their reasoning. And he wants people to use their heart. What does the Bible say about the heart? It is deceitful above all things. In other words, it's an emotional thing that they want you to get involved in. Zig Ziglar goes around to various businesses and he speaks to their salesmen to get them motivated so that they can sell their products and services. Well, the authors of this book obviously want him to sell people on a concept, which obviously is a hard sell without this motivation. Throughout this book, there's three issues that constantly are raised. One is name-calling, using the terms racist, racism, prejudice. These terms are always constantly used in an emotional manner. Another topic that's always talked about is evolution. How they're against evolution, you know, and everything like this. And a third topic is about Hitler and Nazism. And they equate any racial differentiation with mad dog Hitler who wants to eliminate all the Jews and Gypsies, you know. Again, it's an emotional thing that they're trying to come up with. So there are only two positions you can take, you know. There's distorted understanding of racism and evolution and Hitler and Nazism, or their emotional viewpoint on race and God's viewpoint. But maybe there's another position on this matter. We'll just have to let the facts determine that. Now the topic of one blood, when you read this book from Acts 17, you would expect that a book like this would have an in-depth study on that verse. But there's only a couple of off-handed statements made about it, and it's quoted only once in here. And that's on the very last page, of all things. Page 167. And he has made all nations of men of one blood to dwell on the face of the earth, ordaining for the appointed seasons and boundaries of their dwellings. Then they state this. The point is, all human beings are descendants of Adam. All need to build their thinking on God's word and accept that they are sinners in need of salvation. We all need to treat every human being as our relative. We are of one blood. And recognize that all of us are equal in value before our God Creator. Now, reading the Bible, it's really hard to understand how everybody is of equal value to God. Because he picks some and each rejects others. That just flies in the face of that statement. Well, there's no biblical exegesis on that verse. It just shocked me. You think there would be. There's only a presumption that this definition of blood relatives exists. And since the main issue of this book is based upon a presumption, it's a badly written book, in my opinion. Before going on to the book, let's first examine this verse in Acts 17 and see what it says and what it does not say. Now, a good many authorities, probably most authorities, will acknowledge or mention that the word blood is not in the ancient manuscripts or the best manuscripts, as they call it. And Bibles that do use the word blood will have a little footnote there and say, well, that will state this, that it's not in original manuscripts and things like that. But we're just going to set that matter aside for now and try to figure out what the word blood could have meant. Does it mean that all blood is the same in a biological sense, in a genetic sense? Well, we know that there are different blood types. There's type A, type B, type O, type A negative, B positive, AB negative, O positive, and all that. And there's such a difference in these types of blood that if you give a transfusion of one type to a person who has another type, they can die. It is also known that the blood contains a genetic component called alleles. Alleles are basically a special type of gene, so just use the word gene instead. And it's also known that the frequency or amount of these genes in the blood can be found in a great abundance in one race and hardly at all in another race. I got some copies from a book there called The Species of Man by Thomas Allen. And he's got some information on this. He says this, quote, "The blood of the races varies at least statistically. The percentage of the population of the several races have certain blood groups and alleles, the genes, which vary enough so that a race of a population, if not a particular individual, can often be identified based upon blood analysis. Further, a person's blood can often eliminate him as a member of a particular race. The Diego blood antigen is absent in Aryans and Negroes, but high in Orientals. The K gene is common in Aryans, but is rare in Negroes and Orientals. The Sepper gene occurs only in Negroes. Australians have an extremely low frequency of the B gene, approaching zero. Asians and Orientals have a high frequency of the B gene. Blood group A12 is found in Negroes, but is seldom found in Aryans or Orientals. Contrary to popular myth, the races do not share a common blood. However, even a chimpanzee with type A blood can receive a transfusion of a human type A blood. So there are similarities and there are great differences in the blood, genetically and biologically. This is a copy from the book Races and People by William Boyd and Isaac Asimov. On the topic of blood groups, this is what they say. A person's blood group is one of his physical characteristics, just as a dark skin may be, or blue eyes, or a hooked nose. Like other physical characteristics, blood groups can be used to divide mankind into races. So we know that the phrase one blood cannot mean the same blood or that it's genetically the same. This is especially true since the subject of genetics didn't exist at the time of Paul. Even biology didn't. So one blatant error associated with a common interpretation of this verse is trying to apply modern-day concepts and understandings to words that were used 2,000 years ago when those concepts didn't even exist. See, when we use the word blood in modern times, we often use it to denote race or heritage or relationship. We'll say something like he's of English blood or one quarter Negro blood, or we talk about mixed blood or somebody who doesn't have a drop of royal blood in them. But when it's used in biblical times, it's not used in that way. And I've got some quotes here from some Bible authorities on this. The Zondervan Victoria Bible Dictionary says this, "The blood contains the vital principle or the essence of animal and human life. Genesis 9:4 says, but flesh with life thereof, which is of the blood thereof, ye shall not eat. Because of the sacredness of life, that energy which God can give, the Israelites were enjoined from eating the blood." In the Complete Word Study Dictionary of the New Testament, it says, "Blood is used as the substantial basis of individual life in John 1:13 and Acts 17:26. The expression corresponds to the idea contained in Leviticus 17:11, which states, for the life of the flesh is in the blood. Blood by itself serves to denote life passing away in bloodshed and generally life taken away by force. In Thayer's Greek English Lexicon, it says, it was anciently believed that the blood is a seed of life. So this is how they used the term blood. It meant the essence of life. The only other way it's used is for atonement or sacrifice. Blood is not used in the Bible to indicate genetic relationship or race. or relationship. Actually, the term blood for genetics is not even really an accurate term. John Baker, in his book Race, says this: "The use of the word blood to indicate relationship has nothing to commend it and might well be abandoned with other medieval superstitions." It's something they came up with in medieval times because they just didn't understand chromosomes and DNA and things like that, so they used blood, the term blood, to denote relationships, blood relationships. So if Paul used the word blood in Acts 17, he would be saying no more than that everyone has the same vital principle of life, blood. Since we are not talking about genetics in this verse, we could say that all people do have the same blood. Once we understand that biblically, blood means the essence of life. We all have this essence of life, not only men, but animals as well. But what does blood do? Blood does the same thing in man as it does in animals. It carries oxygen, nourishment, vitamins, antibodies, and electrolytes to cells and tissues, and takes away waste and carbon dioxide. We all have that in common. And in Ecclesiastics, it kind of defines this further, how we have some commonalities here with animals. It's Ecclesiastics 3, verse 18. "I said in my heart concerning the estates of the sons of men, God test them that they may see that they themselves are like beasts. For what happens to the sons of men also happens to beasts. One thing befalls them. As one dies, so dies the other. Surely they all have one breath. Man has no advantage over beasts, for all is vanity. All go to one place. All are from the dust, and all return to dust." So here it says that we're all of one breath, man and animal. We're all made of one and the same dust. Does that mean we're related? No, it doesn't. Neither does the fact that all people have one blood or one nature of life make them related. So if blood is to be used in this verse, it refers to the life-giving principle in man and animals, which God gave to them all. Now, to get a better understanding of this verse, of what Paul meant in Acts 17, biblical exegesis requires that we look at the context to determine the meaning. So let's look at this verse. Acts 17. Starting in verse 22. "Then Paul stood in the midst of the Areopagus and said, 'Men of Athens, I perceive that in all things you are very religious or superstitious. For as I was passing through and considering the objects of your worship, I even found an altar with the inscription, "The Unknown God." Therefore, the one whom you worship without knowing him, I proclaim to you, God who made the world and everything in it, since he is Lord of heaven and earth, does not dwell in temples made with hands, nor is he worshipped with men's hands, as though he needed anything, since he gives life to all. He gives to all life, breath, and all things. And he has made from one blood every nation of men to dwell upon the face of the earth, and has determined their pre-appointed time and bounds of their habitations." Now, the people of Athens had a lot of pride and ego regarding their culture and their nation. They considered Greek culture to be the best. They considered their academic center to be the best. They considered their idols to be the best. They had a lot of national pride. Here's what J.R. Dumelo said in his Bible commentary about this, these verses. "The Apostle Paul rebukes the narrow pride of the Greeks, who divided mankind into Greeks and barbarians, the latter being of no account." So you're either a Greek or you're just a no-count barbarian. So there's two main issues that Paul is addressing to these people. One is all their idols and idolatry, and two is their conceited national pride. Paul is telling them that there's one God who made all things, including all nations. Nations here is the key word. See, everybody reads Acts 17:26 as though it says this: God has made of one blood all men. That's not what it says. It says God has made of one blood all nations of men. The issue is nations, which consist of men, but which God established. God established the nations, including Greece. I was wondering, why didn't I see this before? I guess sometimes we get conditioned by the erroneous interpretations of this verse, and we just develop a mental block. Once we understand that the issue is nations, we can see that the word blood does not fit in here very well. The better reading of this verse is this: God made from one every nation of men. It should be from, not of. From every nation, not of. And there's a lot of Bible commentaries and authorities that show that it should be from. Peake's commentary, the Revised Bible had it, American Standard, Interpreter's Bible, Amplified Bible, and so forth. It's from one. What's the one in this verse? Well, looking again at the context and the Bible as a whole, many authorities seem that this is an allusion to Adam. Let's look at some of these authorities, what they say. In Bollinger's Companion Bible, it says this, the phrase, he says, one blood. The text omits blood. The one here either means Adam or the dust of which he was formed. The Interpreter's Commentary Bible says this: from one, i.e., from Adam. Some manuscripts add blood. In Peake's Commentary of the Bible, it says, from one. The Western text adds blood, probably failing to realize that the reference is to Adam. The Oxford Annotated Bible says, from one, i.e., one man, Adam. I think that the one is a reference to Adam. Remember now, it would not read that God has made of Adam all men. Rather, it would read, God has made from Adam all nations. Now, one helpful clue in understanding the Bible is getting a Bible that has cross-references. Acts 17:26 is cross-referenced to Deuteronomy 32:8. Which you just heard in the previous message. And it states this: when the Most High divided their inheritance to the nations, when he separated the sons of Adam, he set the boundaries of the people according to the number of the children of Israel. So you have a similar message here in Deuteronomy and Acts 17:26. Some other Bibles quote it a little differently. They'll say, like in Moffat, all nations has he created from a common origin. See, but God used the sons of Adam to form the nations, as they were known in biblical times at least. That's the common origin, or the from one, that Paul is talking about. See, before Adam, there really were no nations. Adam's descendants spread out over the earth, forming nations. Particularly so in Genesis 10, you know, with Noah's sons and their sons. They formed nations, and many times these nations were named after these patriarchs. So that's what Paul is basically saying here. The same thing that's said in Deuteronomy. God has made from Adam all nations. I think that the word blood is an interpolation in the Masoretic text. I know some people have a real problem with something like that. You know, I just had a meeting in Wisconsin. You know, I try to tell some people that, the word Jew and Gentile really isn't in the Bible. And he just about hit the ceiling and said, "You mean God can't preserve His Word?" Well, of course he had his official King James Bible, probably autographed too and everything, you know, that he was using it as a source. And I proceeded to tell him a little bit of history about the King James Bible here, to just digress a little. The first edition of that Bible that came out was a mess. It was loaded with typographical errors, spelling errors, punctuation errors, lines out of place, places where the masculinity, femininity, he and she were reversed or something like that. And the seventh commandment was missing the word not. So it read, "Thou shalt commit adultery." That's your first edition of the King James Bible. The second edition wasn't much better. After the next 3 years, they revised that thing about 4, 5, 6 times. In 1929, they got a bunch of people together to revise it again. See, so you don't have a first edition or a second edition King James. You wouldn't want one. But the fact is, God is infallible. Men are not, even when it comes to copying and translating Bibles. Well, getting back to the book. As I read through this book, you know, I'm pretty confident that it's not a book of biblical exegesis or a book of scholarship or studious research. It's not scientific. It's just some opinion that they have to promote, and they came out with this book. In the preface of this book, it gives an account of Hitler and his final solution for the Jewish problem, which kind of shows, you know, where they're getting their information from, the media. They're just repeating what they hear, you know, on the TV, and it works really good as an emotional appeal. They also mention, you know, these topics of racism. You know, it said, "Remember the beastly dragging death of the man in by white supremacists, then remember what's in your heart." What about the thousands and thousands of other cases where blacks or Hispanics have brutally killed, raped, maimed white people? It's like a ratio of 50 to 1. Again, that clearly indicates where they're getting their information from. Chapter 1 is Cain's life. Chapter 1 is all about Cain's wife. And this has been a particular issue for a long time. If you remember the Scopes monkey trial, they brought this issue up, you know, and the issue between evolution and creation and so forth. And so, to put it short, their explanation is that Cain married one of his sisters. And then, of course, we got the problem about Cain going out to build a city. And again, they said, well, this is just some of his brothers and sisters again. And what about the dialogue that Cain had with God, you know, immediately after Cain kills Abel, which kind of shows that there are other people there. And again, they just say it's some of his brothers and sisters and relatives. Of course, this is merely speculative that the other children of Adam and Eve have were born before Cain killed Abel. I mean, that's what they're thinking. You know, the Bible does talk about Adam and Eve having other children. They're just saying that it happened before Cain killed Abel, when the Bible shows that it was really after. So it doesn't really conform to the chronology in Genesis. And can you really believe that just a handful of people, their brothers and sisters, would be something that could constitute a city? Can you really believe that Cain's brothers and sisters would follow him, would leave Adam and Eve and follow Cain as a leader, somebody who God has cursed and put a mark upon. This is pretty outlandish, you know, to believe that. Now, the reason for the speculation they got on page 23. If Christians cannot defend that all humans, including Cain's wife, can trace their ancestry ultimately to Adam and Eve, then how can they understand and explain the gospel? How can they justify sending missionaries to every tribe and nation? One needs to be able to answer the question of Cain's wife to illustrate that Christians can defend the gospel and all that it reaches. We've got to defend their gospel that they believe. And that's why the speculation. In fact, it goes beyond speculation. It's really fabrication. Everybody has a gospel, and they have one too. And it just does not line up with the facts of the Bible and the facts of history and science. Chapter 2 of this book is on natural selection and speciation. And they quote chapter 1, you know, where God created plants and animals after their kind. The phrase, after its kind, they say, refers to the individual types of animals and plants. They say, now evolutionists teach that one kind of animal changed into another over millions of years. And then they state this on the next page. Creationists agree that animals and plants change. It's the same thing evolutionists. They say over here, evolutionists believe that animals and plants change, and then they say that creationists agree that animals and plants change. For instance, dogs change, but they change into different varieties or breeds of dogs. We observe many different dogs, such as dingoes and wolves, coyotes, and poodles and St. Bernards and so forth. And then they got a picture here, showing a wolf and a coyote and a collie and a poodle. And how all those, where did the poodle come from? Well, they say mutations occur because of the curse that resulted from the judgment because of sin recorded in Genesis 3. Did animals sin? Genesis 3:17 says this, cursed is the ground for your sake. In toil you shall eat of it all the days of your life. It doesn't say animals are cursed. It just means that Adam and his descendants are now going to have to work and toil to get food. It's not going to be easy pickings like it was in Eden. But anyhow, nobody has ever observed a wolf changing into a poodle or a collie. But they talk about mutations. They believe that's how it happened. That's exactly what evolutionists say. See, also we got here on page 47. The process of natural selection and mutation can never form new kinds of animals or plants, but only new species or varieties when it's in the same kind. Well, the word kind means species. But they believe that new species can be formed. So they're just basically evolutionists. Chapter 3 is on genetics and the human family. Here's some things they quote from different people. Reporting on research conducted on the concept of race, the American ABC News science page stated, more and more scientists find that the differences that set us apart are cultural, not racial. Cultural differences are born out of the different characteristics that races have. And this is the way it has been understood for hundreds of years. see what else we got here. The truth, though, they say, is that these so-called racial characteristics are only minor variations among people groups. Scientists have found that if one were to take any two people from anywhere in the world, the basic genetic differences between these two people would typically be around 0.2%, even if they came from the same group. This is something that you often kind of hear. The percentages changes, you know, sometimes they say it's 99.5% or 99.8% or something like that, that are genetically the same. Actually, it's 90, what they're not saying genetically the same, they're saying they have the same genes, if you ever read all of what they're saying, these scientists. But these same scientists will also say that man and chimpanzees have 99% of the same genes, or are genetically the same. Why don't they quote that? Because that would make us related to chimpanzees. Actually, this is all an erroneous concept because they're just really looking at individual genes. But genetics involves more than just individual genes. It matters what the loci of the gene is, where it's located on the chromosome. If you take one gene and put it on a different place in the chromosome, it's going to give a different characteristic, a different result. Also, it matters how genes are combined. You take these two genes and combine it with this one, it's going to be different than you take them and combine it with a different one. It's kind of like all the elements we've got. We've got 100 elements, 103 elements or something like that, and everything in the universe is made out of these 100 elements. But everything in the universe is not the same, is it? You can state that man and chimpanzee have 100% the same elements. I don't have a problem with that. They're just rearranged different. They're put in different order. You see, there's more to chemistry than just these individual 100 elements. It's how they're put together in compounds and chemical reactions and everything like that. And there's more to genetics than just individual discrete genes. Chapter 4 is titled One Race. They say this: virtually all evolutionists would now agree that the various peoples did not have a separate origin. So they would agree with biblical creationists that all people groups have come from the same original population. They continually support evolutionary concepts throughout this whole book. One reason for this is that many people believe that the observable differences come from some people having unique features in their hereditary makeup, which others lack. This is an understandable but incorrect idea. And two examples they give are the color of the skin, which has different levels of melanin, which is the color. The more melanin a person has, the darker they are. And they said, well, the only difference is that this person has more of this coloration in it than the other person. And they'll state the other issue about Orientals, why they have closed slanted eyes. And they said, well, Orientals have more fat layer filled in the upper eyelid, which creates a lower lid with the eye appearing more closed. So they have more fat. And they say that these issues are not hereditary differences. Well, if it's been going on for 6,000 years, I'd like to know what it is then. Actually, there are animals that have this coloration, melanin, in their skin. There are animals that have fat in their eyelids. Does that make us related to them too? They go on making a big issue of heredity and skin color, as though skin color is the main issue of race. You know, it's very a minor one. It makes no mention of other differences like skull shapes, bone sizes and thicknesses, nose and lip sizes, different types of hair, beards. Why voice is different due to the different shape of a larynx, dental characteristics, body proportions, physiological and behavioral differences. None of this is mentioned. They do mention this for the reason. So we see that the pressure of the environment can affect A, the balance of genes within a group, and B, even to eliminate an entire group. It's exactly what evolutionists have been saying for decades. On page 76, they got, well, this issue of Adam and Eve with all the different races, and they compare it to a cake mix. How you have one recipe of a cake mix, and you can get all these different kinds of cakes from this one recipe. Now, I don't know, but if you gave a cake recipe to 10 bakers, it's got to be the same, because the recipe dictates the ingredients, the proportion of the ingredients, how long it's baked, and what type of pan it's baked, and everything. It's not going to be all these different cakes like they show here. I mean, this is almost stupid. Is this something that a 10-year-old came up with, or what? And then they talk about some primitive races like Australian Aborigines and American Indians, how they're dated back to 40,000 years. Thus, you know, if this is true, they can't be descendants of Adam and Eve, and thus would have no soul. So that's a theological reason why they have to get this up, what they think about souls and so forth like that. Chapter 5 is interracial marriage. And they bring the purpose of marriage, and they got a picture of a black man and a white woman. They're both Christian, so that's good. And they got a picture of a white man and an Oriental woman. They're both non-Christian, so that's fine and dandy. And they got a picture of a white man and a white woman. One's Christian, one not, so that's a bad marriage. Yeah. And they bring up the issue of Rahab and Ruth as interracial marriages. Well, I cover those in my book on universalism, so I'm not going to cover them here. Chapter 8 is about Stone Age people. And I thought this was going to cover some of the history of man. And it doesn't. It's just less than 2 pages. And they state some things. The Australian Aborigines have a technology and cultural knowledge. They can, because that's, well, which is appropriate to them. And they talk about them being able to make boomerangs. Sometimes, though, we see evidence of degeneration that is hard to explain, but is real nonetheless. It is hard to explain. It's real hard for them to explain. And they talk about the Tasmanians who can sew skins together and so forth. Well, I don't know what that's supposed to mean, really. Chapter 10 is a very interesting topic. It's about a pygmy by the name of Oda Benga, who was brought to America and displayed in a zoo, the Bronx Zoo. And he was displayed next to an orangutan, I guess, and he was made to do all sorts of dumb tricks, and everybody was talking about how barbarian this race is and so forth. And they make a big emotional thing about this, about as why there was such a mistreatment of this pygmy that was brought to America, that we should therefore not be like that, because I mean, you're one step from Mad Dog Hitler, you know, with that type of thinking. They quote some places, Scientific American, which says this: the personal appearance, characteristics, and traits of the Congo pygmies are small, ape-like, and elfish creatures who live in the dense, tangled forest in absolute savagery. And while they exhibit many ape-like features in their bodies, they possess a certain alertness which appears to make them more intelligent than other Negroes. Another scientific journal says they are often dirty yellow-brown in color and covered with a fine down. Their faces are fairly hairy with great progressivism and retreating chin. While in general they are unintelligent and timid, having little tribal cohesion, and usually living upon the fringes of other tribes. You know, they don't refute any of this. They do have these characteristics and traits. They do look like that. What they do say in rebuttal of this on page 137 is this. The Pygmies were in fact a talented group, experts in mimicry, physically agile, quick, nimble, and superior hunters. Is that the traits that build high civilizations? Mimicry? That's located with, usually associated with low intelligence, like a child or a chimpanzee. It mimics. But as far as their technology, it says they can make string figures. I'm not sure what that is, some sort of art form. I mean, are we now technologically equal to them? Is all of our great blessings of inventions and discoveries due to these pygmies in the Congo? Do we have all this great technology? I mean, when you see some high technological device, is that because of some pygmy technology or something? I mean, nobody, everybody hears that, they would think it absurd. You could say it's made of alien technology and they wouldn't think it's so strange because at least they heard that. Nobody's ever heard of pygmy technology. But they make a real pointed issue of this. A summary of this book, the book is deliberately avoids the verses in the Bible that show God's distinction in racial groups or inequality that God has made for persons and nations. It avoids scientific evidence of racial distinctions such as IQ, crime rates, medical evidence. It does not address the history of the races, the difference in ability to advance and build civilizations. It never addresses the anthropological evidence of human types living tens of thousands of years before Adam. It is a book that uses emotional arguments, evolutionary principles, prejudicial statements, speculative theology, and unscientific claims to support its humanistic doctrine. It uses name-calling. It's always been a concept of the communists. If you can't out-debate your opponent, resort to name-calling. Racism, prejudice, Hitler, all these names that are derogative, they use them constantly. And the tactic works quite well because we have a book like this and that's what it's based upon. And they use it throughout the book quite well. Well, that's my summation of the book and at that topic of Acts 17. So thank you for your attention.